It did rain once this season, but then the California high returned, and forecasters now call for an extended period of sunny and dry. All this nice weather leads us to ask, can we grow enough food farming this big dry?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 999th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among for friends way down there in Puerto Madryn who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels back at the Broadcast Central in Santa Cruz, California. Folks, today we're broadcasting live from the EcoFarm Conference in Pacific Grove, California. Having attended EcoFarm conferences a couple dozen times, I can say without almost exception, it always rains here. But last year, it only drizzled, and this year, it's nothing but nice, with the forecast calling for more nothing but nice to follow. All this nice weather and the promise of more to come portends a continuation of California's multi-year drought, now going into our fourth year, as a matter of fact. While some argue over whether California's big dry is simply another in a long history of droughts, or is the product of anthropomorphic climate change, those who grow our food argue about the best way to adapt to the lack of water. Now, what better way place to look for answers than in the world's desert oasis, where farmers use technologies refined over centuries of use to grow food? These technologies include biomimicry, ecomimicry, and ethnomimicry. Can these technologies be adapted to good effect by modern agriculture here in the developed world? Well, let's ask the man himself, Mr. Desert, Gary Paul Nabhan. He was a professor of sustainable food systems at the University of Arizona. Welcome back to the Food Chain, Gary.
It's great to be back. 999. Does that mean I'm not a millennial?
You're one short of a millennial, but that's close, right? So when we last spoke, it was number 965, and we were talking about the spice trade in the desert. What a fascinating story that was. I had to go out and buy some frankincense.
Well, frankincense is food, not just medicine and incense, and you're right. And I'm doing an event at Omnivore Books Tuesday on that wonderful thing in the Bay Area, and it's just a story of how desert peoples, the spice traders, influence the whole global economy.
And it was a magnificent story, and if you think about it, what better thing to start the world off getting along than trade? And what better substance than frankincense? It was a great, great story. Well, here we are again, and we're at EcoFarm Conference, which is on the beautiful Monterey Peninsula. We're on a deck overlooking the Pacific Ocean. We can see these giant waves rolling in from across the Pacific and crashing on the beach, and the sunrise is catching the spray from the crashing waves.
And I just saw some great whales a second ago.
Great whales out there, and you look across, and there's the Spanish Bay Golf Course, and it's just absolutely extraordinary. But, gosh, you know, in all of the years I've been coming here, it almost always rains. And today it's just absolutely sunny and clear, severe clear, and it's supposed to be severe clear for a long time.
Maybe it's because you all invited me up from Arizona and brought the dry weather with me.
Brought some Arizona with you. Yeah, good enough. Well, you know, we're looking at year number four of a severe drought here in California. You know, we did have one rain, thank the Lord, because without that, we'd be in terrible, terrible shape. But the fact remains is that we're running pretty short of water. Now, when you have weather like we do here in California, this hot, dry weather, it's great for growing things. You know, I mean, it really is. But you have to have water to grow the things. And so that's what California is faced with. Right now, what California is doing essentially is robbing savings account to water the crops. We're taking water out of our reservoirs. We're taking it out of our aquifers, and we're not replacing it. So we're spending. I guess the expression is we're eating our seed corn when it gets right down to our water. So we got to figure out how to come to grips with this, and what better way to come to grips with it than to look to those people who have lived with dry conditions for hundreds of years, and that would be those people who live in the deserts. And Gary, that's your purview, is the desert. How did you get to be such a desert person in the first place?
Well, I'm an Arab American, and my grandfather was a sheep herder and orchard keeper on the Lebanon-Syria border. There's not much left of that border right now, as you know. But then I lived in sand dunes while I was growing up, so we even had to think about it because I was in a coastal area where the water went right through the sand. But I dropped out of high school by age 19. I was in the desert, and the desert has been my mentor. And fortunately, there are mentors, farmers, that are still part of an unbroken tradition of 4,100 years of continuous agriculture in the counties that I've lived in Arizona. So we have that unbroken
4,100 years?
That's the oldest agriculture in North America, and corn and squash and other crops have been found literally within a few hundred yards of my office in a desert field station that are the evidence that we've had this unbroken chain of agriculture in the Tucson Basin that long.
Wow.
So there's a lot to learn from the living farmers who are part of the traditions that have distilled a lot of knowledge about that. One of the interesting things about that is they will never say, well, I guess the drought is broken, we've had a rain. They have a whole grammatical structure to talk about conditional long-term probabilities, and you would never be so arrogant as to say the drought is broken. You'd say, I think maybe perhaps we had a little bit of rain that may change how we look at the drought.
So the drought is always with us, and maybe we get some rain, which is a blessing, and but we don't say the drought is broken because that would be to tempt fate, right?
And, of course, we heard people say that last spring, I believe, when we had one rain in some parts of California. But now we're facing something where as much as 800,000 acres in California may be fallow this year for lack of water in our reservoirs. And so this is not just affecting farmers. It's affecting everyone in California because you all love the fresh produce here, but it's really affecting the entire United States because you're the largest agricultural economy in the United States and in the world.
And it's not just affecting those acres that have been taken out of production, but it's also having an impact of those acres that are still in production because they have to get their water from someplace, and if there's not water there to get, you know, they kind of have to steal it from someplace, essentially. And when you take all the water out of your aquifer, it's really taking water from the future because it's not going to be there anymore.
Well, it's actually more serious than that, in fact. My brother-in-law is a pecan farmer over by Las Cruces, New Mexico. They were usually given 10 irrigations from a reservoir each year. The last 2 years, they've been given one, which means none of them can keep their pecans alive just on one irrigation. So they've had more perforations of the aquifer, more new drilling for wells, and the water is getting increasingly salinized.
Yeah.
And because of that, that water might not be good at all in the future unless we come up with brilliant desalinization technology. So it's not just robbing from the future, it's destroying the reserves that we have.
Kind of see something that you see across the board, even in the great Oglala Aquifer in the central part of the United States, you see that same condition there.
That's right. Lubbock, Texas really can't furrow irrigate cotton or its other crops now. In fact, Howard Buffett, Warren Buffett's son, recently told me there should not be an acre of furrow irrigation left in the western U.S. We could cut our water waste by half if we switch to microdispersion water harvesting and other techniques to reduce our taxation of the aquifer.
You can see that happening here in the Central Coast because we have very high value crops, you know, like the berry crops and whatnot. And you don't see sprinklers anymore. You don't see furrow irrigation anymore because everything is underground almost. I hear the music. That means we're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program number 999 with Gary Paul Nabhan, who is the professor of sustainable agriculture, sustainable food systems at the University of Arizona, Tucson, a beautiful city out there in the desert, high desert. And you, of course, the subject today is water. And can we grow enough food if the rains don't fall? How are we going to come to grips with that? Are there technologies that we should be looking at in other cultures, in other ways, that we could bring into modern agriculture here in the United States that would make sense, that would allow us to grow food? Please do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're broadcasting live from the EcoFarm Conference in Pacific Grove, California. Oh, my goodness. You should see what it looks like from our perspective. Looking across the deck through the trees down to the beach, you can see these beautiful waves rolling in from the Pacific coast. They're crashing on the beach, and there's an offshore wind, so it catches the foam and picks it up into the air where the rising sun illuminates it. It's just absolutely stunning. There's whales out there. There's golf course across the way and a forest filled with people talking about ecological agriculture. One of the big subjects here today is how on earth are we going to figure out how to grow our food when the rains quit falling, as they have done here in California. This is the fourth year of a big drought. And the way we're growing water right now is we're stealing it from the future. We're taking it out of our reservoirs. We're taking it out of our groundwater. We're not replenishing it. So you know what happens when you spend your savings and don't replace them. Pretty soon you don't have any savings left, and that's exactly kind of what we're looking at with our water. So we're looking at ways that we can come to grips with this and develop new technologies, perhaps from very old technologies. And Gary Nabhan, who is a professor of sustainable food systems at the University of Arizona, is here to help us out with that. Gary has been traveling around and writing a lot of fun books about desert agriculture. One of my favorites that just came out with was Coming Camels and Caravans, in a story of the early spice trades through the deserts. And maybe some of those desert oases that you talk right about can point the direction to us, Gary.
Well, one of the most remarkable places I've had the good fortune to travel to is Siwa Oasis, and that's on the Libya-Egypt border. It's in Egypt, about 400 miles into the Saharan Desert, and then there's a place that looks a little bit like El Indio, California, but where agriculture has been going on literally for millennia, and because of early travelers.
But first, how do you get 400 miles into the Sahara Desert? It's like a road or something?
There's one paved road from the coast of the Mediterranean that you have to travel 4 hours from Alexandria to even get to, and then you just go south across blazing desert. There's not a single house. We only saw one Bedouin caravan the entire time. If you have a flat tire out there and it's 125 degrees,
you get cooked.
You're you're cooked by the time you get your tire back on the car. So I had a remarkable thing. I have to just tell you this, the backstory. Sort of my academic grandfather, the first desert agricultural scientist at University of Arizona, went there in 1918, and I heard from a Native American woman that he had brought her plants from there that she planted in Arizona, and she said, I think he has pictures someplace in Tucson of his trip. I got all those pictures, and when I went to Egypt, I took them back to the grandchildren wow. of who had visited this, who had hosted this man from Arizona, and they opened the doors for me. They'd never seen photos of their grandparents.
Wow. So
they were Berber, not Arab people. In any case, that oasis has been dealing with drought, heat, and salinity for millennia. And one of the most interesting things is that what permaculturalists call stacking functions of growing trees that have understory crops, that have other crops under them, they have five strata of agricultural crops growing together to protect each subsequent understory crop from the sun. And they plant the crops on a horizontal gradient from the most saline-tolerant ones where the salt kind of forms a crust to the most sensitive ones where there's no crust at all right beneath the trees. The trees' roots are kind of doing that. So you might have date palms with olive trees underneath.
So the date palms would be the most tolerant of the sun, and they would be up high.
That's right. So they're forming this feathery canopy, and then the olive trees are forming a denser canopy, and then you have pomegranates underneath that, and perhaps grapevines twining up the pomegranates and olives. And then you have things like hibiscus shrubs or chili plants, and then you have cilantro or coriander, whatever you want to call it, and almost ground-hugging herbs underneath that. Sometimes seven strata, just like you'd get in a tropical rainforest, except this is compressed. And it's really not just to give the trees a buffer from high solar radiation and heat, but also those trees are pumping up nutrients from deeper in the soil.
Way down deep,
and redistributing water and sharing mycorrhizae. So that it's really an ecosystem like the permaculturalists have spoken to you about on other shows.
Sure, sure. So, and of course, this is an ecological system, a permaculture system that evolved over many centuries.
And what ecologists call resource partitioning, where they're really not in competition for water or nutrients, but they're almost sharing.
Everybody's
so
sharing.
That's right.
And protecting and cooperating.
And so that's the paradox about deserts. When you first look at it, you say, oh, water scarcity, all these plants must be competing for water. Well, there is scarce water resources at oases, not so much. But it's really that they're collaborating. I mean, they are our allies in farming. If we think that we are farming in the face of climate change alone, we'll get scared and have anxiety attacks. If we think that we are co-farming with a bunch of brilliant plants and a bunch of brilliant soil microbes, the edge of loneliness may wear off
a little bit.
We get something done. I'm really about the solutions, not the problems.
Uh-huh. Well, and, you know, I ran into one of those, too, down in Baja California Sur. And I was just driving along, and there was a little crease in the landscape, and there must have been a spring there or something because there was a beautiful, lush, verdant landscape. They were growing everything imaginable, and it was just like this perfect little oasis.
Well, as a matter of fact, the last 5 years since I finished those books that are about the deserts of the old world, I've been spending time with my students almost like in a field school all the way down to the tip of Baja California Peninsula. We've hit 14 oases and documented their entire food biodiversity in them, but then gone back to the early Spanish records to see what the Spanish introduced 300 years ago that made it and didn't make it. And you can literally see the first mission olives that were planted at San Javier, Mission San Javier, not far from Todos Santos and Loreto, the same tree that they planted in 1716.
Still there.
And they're larger than most people's living room and their circumference and 40, 50-foot olive trees that are healthy and still producing olives. So there's a tenacity there in how the people have done their agriculture. They don't throw away the lessons from the past. They integrate them with new innovations all the time, and that's what I want to say the most. We need to draw on those ancient traditions, but innovate them and adapt them to the scales of agriculture. Obviously, their scale is not the same as most of the California agriculture we see, but the principles apply.
You know, when you talk about that kind of an environment, you know, it's a desert oasis is by definition an isolated world.
That's right.
And in that kind of world, it would be easy, much easier to maintain the traditions and the knowledge that's passed down from one generation to next, because it's not going to go away. It's not going to go off to California and hang out on the beach, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to pretty much stay there. And in that kind of environment also, the people who are ingenious and industrious will be making the experiments and trying things and seeing how things work. So I was curious about the people themselves that live in these. Ah, I hear the music, but we'll pick this up when we get back.
Sure.
Folks, we're talking about agriculture in the great deserts of the world, kind of looking nervously over our shoulder at the great California drought. California, of course, responsible so much of the fresh food we eat and here in the United States. So we're looking at the fourth year of this drought and going, oh my goodness, are we going to be able to manage and hold on? And how are we going to grow food? Perhaps these people who have lived with the great dry all of their lives will have some lessons for us. And who better to relate those lessons to us than Gary Paul Nabhan, the professor of sustainable food systems at the University of Arizona, where it is arid, and they do know about these things. Please do stay tuned. Right back, we're going to talk about the people of the oasis when we come return. We are back, and we are at EcoFarm, which is a conference bringing together people from throughout the United States and actually through the world to talk about ecological agriculture and how we can grow our food in a more sustainable way. Today it's absolutely stunning here, which is kind of strange because it almost always rains at EcoFarm, but not this year. As a matter of fact, it's so sunny and so severe. We're out here on the deck overlooking the Pacific Ocean, Spanish Bay, and we're taking off our clothes with Gary Paul Nabhan, and I'm going to be without any clothes here if this sun keeps beating down on us. It's so nice. And we're talking about ways the technologies people use over the centuries and developed in more arid cultures. And are any of these technologies suitable for bringing back here to the Western world, to the developed world, where we use these super high modern technologies to grow our food? And in thinking about the desert, the oasis that you were talking about, Gary, how you have a relatively small area in which all kinds of things are growing. And here in the Western world, we have great big spaces where only one thing is grown.
That's right.
And so what can we pick up from that?
Well, you know, the question of scale is one of the key ones. I think the brilliance of the eco-farm practitioners is sometimes dismissed by big industrial agriculture as not being scalable. They'll say, well, that works good on a 3-acre plot, but we can't ramp that up to save California agriculture. We have to use high-tech solutions. And that word high-tech always bothers me, because some of the most ancient technologies that have shown that they're durable are also high-tech in ways. And one of them is the Ganad or Keras horizontal well systems that extend from Yemen, where they probably began, or Persia perhaps, all the way through Western China. And they're called Keras in Western
China.
Kind
of along the caravan routes, right?
That's right. So when we talked about the Silk Road routes, that was one of the reasons I made it into the Gobi Desert, to the Turpan Basin, where they're masters of water harvesting on a scale of 20 to 25,000 acres.
Wow.
Of croplands, beautiful, beautiful, and vegetables, probably 10 to 15 tons of of vegetable harvest per year without using any groundwater. And what they do is capture the runoff off the mountains just beyond them, maybe 20 to 30 miles, and it flows like a river, almost like a sheet flood, down under sand dunes. And they, for centuries, have gone down and tapped into that by first drilling or digging vertical wells of about 20 to 30 feet deep, sometimes 50 feet deep, and then making tunnels that are called horizontal wells or gannats. And so these extend for miles. You might have a 10-mile-long tunnel running under sand dunes into the floodplain basins where it comes out as a canal when you get out of the sand dunes or
wow.
from under the sand dunes. And so these hold millions and millions of tons of water. It's almost like tapping into a shallow spring 30 to 50 feet under the ground.
It's
all runoff.
Yeah.
It's not groundwater in the technical sense. And so they...
it's water. Runoff that didn't run off. It gets captured.
That's right. And so they're just under the sand dunes, capturing all this runoff. It's saved from evaporation. And the most remarkable thing is that these systems have persisted for 1,500 to 2,000 years, perhaps longer. And they're sustainable in a way that no California agricultural site can yet claim because we haven't had agriculture here that long.
Well, that's one of the things that puzzles me in looking back at history, as you have, and as I have. What you see are technologies that really are incredibly complex, and ably assisted by our KO here. Thank KO for the mic there. When we look at these ancient technological systems for growing food, I think of F.H. King and his farmers of 40 centuries going to China and going to teach Chinese about how to be a smart in agriculture and use all of these modern technologies. And he looks at it and goes, I have nothing to offer these people because what they're doing is so incredibly brilliant for what they have that I can't match that with the things that we use, the big tractors, the crop dusters. It's not here. So when we look at these ancient technologies that evolved over centuries, it's easy for us in the modern world to be kind of dismissive of them, but perhaps we shouldn't. Now, when you look at them, do you see things that could be taken from those ancient technologies and adapted to, the modern landscapes where you have, 100 acres of one thing growing?
That's right. I think if we adapt the principles of that system in the Gobi Desert that is still working on 20 to 40,000 acres there without pumping groundwater, and look for similar geomorphic or topographic sites where we have sand dunes up against one of the mountain ranges in southern Arizona, we could replicate the same thing, perhaps even close to the Imperial Valley. And yet, it takes the humility of King. That's why we read farmers of 40 centuries, decades afterwards, because he said, I don't have anything to teach them until I know what they know, and I may learn more from them than they from me. So, ironically, we're in a place where we have to regain that humility and admit our failures. The industrial ag system of extractive groundwater farming and salinization of our fields is a broken system now. Do we need to say that aloud again? California mainstream agriculture is a broken system. Even if we come out of this drought, the salinization and other things are imperiling it in the long run. Mark Reisner's Cadillac Desert. Scientists went back 20 years after he wrote this book predicting things and found that 8 out of his 10 predictions about California agriculture were not only correct, but they were the severity of the stresses on agriculture are more complex than Reisner had mentioned. So we need to learn from these other systems and then Our innovation will be adapting them to the scale and to the terrain here in California, in Arizona. It's not a simple formula or recipe of taking it from one place to the other. We have to do that intellectual and pragmatic game of adapting it to the place-based conditions here.
Well, yeah, there is a problem in becoming, you know, accepting the humility of saying that what we're doing could use a little modification because it works, or we think it works, but we're faced with a situation where it may not be working because we have to come to grips with the fact that we have to use less water. And when you use, for example, synthetic nutrients that are suspended in saline solutions and then fed to plants, it has a way of exacerbating the problem. And I'd like to pick that up when we get back and talk about soil and the practices of a soil and how soil can be modified to hold more water and go farther and grow more food. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, it's certainly a nice day here on Pacific Grove, California. I can see perhaps all the way to Japan. That might be Fuji sticking up over the horizon down there. It's that clear today, which is great, but not really, because California needs some rain. Almost always rains here at the Eco Farm Conference in Pacific Grove this time of year, but not this year because it's severe clear. And so we're considering ways of getting more use out of our water by looking at the ways developed to grow food in desert oases around the world. And who better to ask than Gary Paul Nabhan, who's the professor of sustainable food systems at the University of Arizona, which is probably is an arid kind of place. I was thinking about the use of synthetic fertilizers and how they really exacerbate the need for water to keep those salts washed away from the root zone. Do you see any impact on that? Does that relate with respect to any desert agriculture? How do they manage their soils?
Well, one of the most remarkable things that I've learned is from a Sikh farmer who's now in Phoenix, Arizona, but his grandfather taught him many of his techniques. And he took over land that looks like the land between Riverside and El Indio with creosote bush as far as the eye can see. Little tiny shrubs, greasy looking shrubs, and oftentimes caliche or calcium carbonate underneath a few inches of sand. So you can't even dig a deep hole in it. And Ken Singh has taken over a place on an Indian reservation just outside of Scottsdale, Arizona, and put 3 to 4 feet of compost on top of that soil after sort of roughing it up with a root plow. And that more acid, nutrient-rich compost is not only turning around the salinity problem, but it's also dissolving the calcium carbonate in the root zone so that the plants are rooting more deeply. They're not only rooting the 3 feet into the compost, so he's increased the height or the ground level of his fields. But he's doing this on a 20-acre orchard garden that's the most productive single site in Arizona.
Wow.
But he's actually turning around the quality and nutrient and water holding capacity of the deeper soil because these begin to filter down and actually dissolve the calcium carbonate.
How long did it take to do that?
8 years.
8 years?
He's getting 30 to 40 foot tall fruit trees in 6 years.
Wow.
It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. You cannot hear the racket of Phoenix, Arizona. There's a interstate highway. It'd be like farming on a clover leaf in L.A., and he has so much cover of food-producing plants that you can't even hear the highway 300 yards away. It is an oasis, and composting with a microbial-rich culture is what does it. He used to be a microbiologist, and he probably has a 180 different kinds of bacteria and mycorrhizae in that soil. So he cares so deeply about the soil that he says, I'm a cultivator of soil, and everything follows from that.
Yeah.
If I grow the right kind of soil, I can grow any plant here.
Well, that's kind of the opposite.
That's right.
Of what we're doing, of our, they call it conventional agriculture, but I'm always, I want to go to war over that word, because to me, conventional agriculture is the agriculture that has sustained us for millennia, you know?
Well, worse is traditional agriculture, when people say, oh, you all are doing on the fringe stuff, and we do traditional agriculture. There's no tradition to it. It's unprecedented in human history that we would try to deplete our nutrients and our water reserves.
Yeah, so what we're doing with these modern technologies is essentially, the essential thing is to bypass the biological processes of the soil. And in doing so, you know, you put yourself, when you bypass the biological processes to grow plants, which we can do, I mean, we can grow plants in sterile mediums. We don't need soil. But when you do that, you become the god of the process. You become responsible for everything.
And as you know from your many other interviews and exchanges on this show, there's always hidden costs to that. Yes, we can grow plants without soil in sterile media, but what are the fossil fuel costs of doing those highly controlled systems? So we may say, oh, they're saving water, but they're not saving fossil fuel. I mean, you know, there's so many synthetics built into that system that the caloric input per calorie out is just enormous.
So what we see and what you have seen working around the world works very well in some systems, but boy, it would require a great, as you say it, admitting, fessing up to some humility here. Do you see anything that would force us to fess up to that humility?
Well, when we're talking about 800,000 acres going out of cultivation in California, we now know that Governor Brown is interested in helping farmers make transitions to a more water-conscious agriculture. And I think we're going to see the same thing with the loss of pollinators, which is the main issue I'm working on right now. We had a White House pollinator summit. The president is asking his science advisor every time they talk, are the bees and the monarch butterflies recovering yet? I mean, here we are in Pacific Grove, one of the last places that monarchs overwinter. And when we're stripping our system down so that we
right
don't
back,
have the...
Folks, do stay tuned.
Frank Muller has been farming in Woodland with his brothers Louie and Tom for as long as they can remember.
We've been farming since we were kids. But the college years at UC Davis were the big years, because what we learned there, we brought home. Today, we're still working to make farming more productive and friendlier for the environment. Yeah, the future of agriculture looks good.
Find out how UC Davis partners with growers like the Mullers at onecalifornia.ucdavis.edu.
Well, so much to talk about, so little time to talk about it. What can we learn from the traditional cultures of the desert oasis? Can we look at those folks out there who have had to live with dry conditions forever and take what they know and bring it here to the modern world of high, or I can't say it's technologically any more intense than traditional agriculture, because traditional agriculture was technologically intense, but a different kind of technology. Can we take what they knew from those desert oases and bring it here, Gary Knapphound?
I think we can, and that's why I see EcoFarm as an incubator for the future. It's a nursery ground of ideas, some of which we're going to have to mainstream. To do that, we have to get over that it's a them and us kind of situation. We're all in this together. If large-scale agriculture bottoms out, that affects all of us. And so we don't need to take sides on this.
We don't need the Democrats and Republicans, right? What we need is to figure out what works best here.
And to pull off that 20,000 acres of renewable water, renewable energy, agriculture in the Gobi Desert of China, people have to collaborate to keep those systems together. It's not the Marlboro country guy out there is by himself. It's really community-supported agriculture, consumers understanding the challenges that farmers are going through. But we also don't need this divide between big ag and small ag anymore. The big ag people need to feel receptive to the innovations that people here have already worked out, and then scale them up and have a critique of what works and what doesn't that goes back to these many innovators. We really can't afford to have a rural-urban divide or a big ag, small ag divide anymore in the West. We're all facing the same drought, the same water scarcity, and the same food insecurity issues.
Do you think some profit by fostering that divide?
I think radio stations 180 degrees from yours do, but I don't think most of us profit, and I think just a few pundits do. I don't think farmers themselves do. They're hurt by thinking that someone is against them rather than someone is a potential collaborator. And so I'm going this next week to talk about collaborative conservation to ranchers right in the area where you grew up, where we can say the range wars have been going on for 20 years, and now environmentalists and ranchers are collaborating again. And if we can have old hippies and Tea Party ranchers come together in what I call the ideological horseshoe, where now they're almost touching together because they want local self-sufficiency again, and they want to have market-driven solutions that help us all gain a way to keep our landscapes alive. We have it.
It sounds to me like a great deal of humility is called on for everybody concerned.
Well, because I've made so many mistakes in my own life, I get more humble and humble every day, and I actually welcome being told that I'm wrong about something, because that's the only way I can learn. So it's actually a great journey to be on.
Wow. Can't say as I enjoyed many more shows than this. You're sitting here on the deck of Pacific Grove, California, the Asilomar Conference Grounds with Gary Paul Napham, ably assisted by my sidekick, Kelsey Olson, and looking out over the Pacific Ocean and watching the waves crashing. So much water and none to drink.
That's right. But, Michael, you're the best in the West. This is the best show that talks about these issues anywhere west of the Mississippi. So thank you. And good luck going into the next millennium of shows.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.